Good afternoon, and welcome to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. This is Prentice Pemberton sitting in today for host Kathleen McCoy. Protecting abused and neglected children across our vast state is an enormous job that is difficult, complex, and often quite contentious. Protecting children by removing them from their homes is a painful and confusing time for children and for the families who love them. Today on Justice Alaska, the second in a three-part series focusing on the state's role in protecting Alaska's most vulnerable citizens. Subject today's program, Children in Need of Aid, also known as China Cases. Joining me is to lead our discussion is our expert co-host for Justice Alaska, Senior Judge Elaine Andrews. Thanks so much, Judge Andrews, for bringing your experience and expertise to the table for this co-hosting our show today.
Well, thanks a million, Apprentice. Today we have a full studio. We have three people here who are going to join in this discussion, and I'm going to have them introduce themselves and let us know a little bit about what part they play in child in need of aid cases.
Hello, hello everyone. My name is Carla Erickson, and I'm the supervising attorney for the Child Protection Section of the Attorney General's Office. I've held that position since 2007, and with the exception of a brief but very painful stint in patent infringement litigation, child welfare has been my career, and that's been about the sum total of 17 years. The Child Protection Section of the Attorney General's Office represents the Office of Children's Services anytime a child in need of aid case is filed alleging abuse and neglect of a child. And we have 23 attorneys across the state representing a number of OCS offices across the state, and I will be discussing how regional practices vary.
Thanks.
Hello, my name is Linda Beecher. I'm a deputy public defender at the Public Defender Agency. I have worked with the Public Defender Agency since 1989. Similar to Carla, my primary practice area has been in the child welfare area. I provide representation to parents. I work with other attorneys in our office, and as Carla mentioned with her agency, the Public Defender Agency is a statewide agency, and we do have attorneys around the state who provide representation to parents. We provide representation to low-income parents. When a parent is involved in a child welfare case and is low-income, they are entitled to court-appointed counsel. There are other agencies that also provide representation to parents, and of course, parents can also sometimes are required to hire their own counsel. Mainly, our role is to act as the legal advocate for the parent. We provide them with advice. We negotiate on their behalf with other parties. We try to assist them to come to the best possible resolution in their cases. We do also defend them in the courtroom when cases are contested and when evidence is going to be presented.
Thanks, Linda.
Good afternoon. My name's Leanne Reichs, and I'm a guardian ad litem with the Office of Public Advocacy, and I'm also the state director of the Alaska CASA program. CASA stands for Court-Appointed Special Advocate. CASAs are screened and trained community volunteers who basically do the same thing guardian ad litems do, which is to advocate for children in custody of the state. We make recommendations to the court on what we think is in the children's best interest. We're an independent, we do independent investigations. We're not part of OCS. Our main focus is the children and their best interests.
Thanks. Well, we have quite a group here, and although it seems we have a pretty extensive network, we have people who are not here simply because this is such a broad and complex area, we couldn't have everyone speaking at the same time. We don't have someone here from the Office of Children's Services, and that's a person who would generally be in court. And in addition to that, if the child is a Native child, we would probably have a tribal representative in court as well. We would probably have an attorney for the guardian ad litem. And if there were two biological parents, then of course we would have an attorney for each parent. And if the child was in foster care, we might have the foster parents as well. So when these cases come to court, rather than the three people we have in the studio, we might have 7 or 8 or 10 people appearing at a single hearing for a single child.
Okay, this is it's a big topic. It's a really big topic, and as you said, Judge Andrews, we're going to try to keep it keep it more bird's eye view. We can't get down into the OCS investigations pieces of it as much because we do not have an investigations person here. But that perhaps is a different show for a different day. And the native health stuff is pretty in-depth in its own. So those are a couple shows that might be coming down the road. So before we get started, I want to let folks know how we can be reached. You can call us locally at 550-8433 or on our toll-free number at 1-888-353-5752. And you can email your questions to hometown@alaskapublic.org. Please don't hesitate to call in, and call in fairly early because people tend to wait until the last 5 minutes and then we don't have time to get them on the air. So call in if you have a question for our guests or have an experience that you'd like to share or talk about. So, all right, Judge Andrews, I'm going to turn it over to you and let you kind of lead this thing on.
All right. I'm going to begin by asking Carla, maybe you can explain for us the depth and the breadth of the problem. Give us some idea of what are we talking about in terms of numbers. Just why don't we lead off with just trying to get our arms around the size of the problem.
Sure, absolutely. I gathered some data from the OCS website just this morning, and if folks don't know, there's a lot of statistics and publications on OCS's website, and so you can find out a lot about very specific topics if you're so inclined. So if we're not going to hit on a topic that you're particularly interested in today, then the OCS website might be a source of information for you. But on the website, I was able to find out that as of September 2016, there were 3,070 children in out-of-home care, which is a sizable number in Alaska. And you may have heard that we've had an increase in the number of children in out-of-home care, a rather dramatic increase over the last year in particular. So those are the kids who are in some sort of out-of-home care. I also want to give you perspective of how much OCS deals with in terms of whittling down to that number. How do we reach that number? Between September 2015 and October 2016, OCS received approximately 17,000 reports of harm, which means 17,000 instances of someone calling OCS to report a suspicion of abuse or neglect. Many of those calls came from mandated reporters, people who are required to report, such as law enforcement and medical personnel. But calls also come in from family members, neighbors, church, family, whomever has a suspicion of abuse and neglect of a child. Of those 17,000 reports of harm, only approximately 9,000 were investigated. And that's actually still only 9,000. That's right. A lot. That's about 55% of the allegations were investigated. I don't have a number for you to like whittle that down to get to 3,000, but the funnel is a pretty, you know, sizable funnel, right? You start with a lot, and then we get down to the 3,000 kids in out-of-home care.
Okay. And if we're talking about children in out-of-home care, where are they? If they're not in their home, do you have a sense of where most of them are placed?
Yes. So out-of-home care means they're not living with either one of the parents. Most of the kids, about 50% or so, are placed with relatives, which is always the preferred placement. If we can get kiddos with family, that's where they tend to do best. The kids who are not with relatives would be possibly with family friends or licensed care providers, and then there are some children who need a higher level of care that might be in treatment facilities.
Okay. Let me ask Leanne, who deals with children as a guardian ad litem. You deal with, you would come into play after a case has gone to court and the court appoints you as a guardian. The majority of cases that where you are a guardian for a child, are those, where are those children living? And in your opinion, how is it that you come to be their guardian? What caused them to become children in need of aid that you're trying to help them out?
Guardian ad litems are appointed when a petition is filed with the court. And then the Office of Public Advocacy federal law requires that a guardian ad litem is appointed to all kids.
Okay, and maybe we could just stop there. Guardian ad litem is sort of a big word.
Yes, it is.
You're not a guardian like a parent would be a guardian. In other words, you're not you don't take them into your home and take them to school and do those kinds of things.
That's correct. And we do get confused with that a lot. We are not their legal guardian. We're their guardian in ad litem, which means we speak for them in court. We advocate for them and speak for them. You know, we don't have any legal authority to, you know, get them in school and sign permission slips and things like that.
Okay. So the guardian ad litem is a guardian for purposes of litigation, purposes of the court.
Correct.
Okay. Okay. So I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
That's all right. So one of the first things we do is we go out and obviously meet the children, meet the caregivers, and like Carla mentioned, they're usually with relatives, which is great. There also are some children that are still with their parents, and there's been some safety provisions that have been put in the home that they're able to stay with their parents, which is wonderful for kids. So we get to know the kids at home. We'd go visit them at their schools. We talk with their teachers, their therapists, any relatives, anybody who has some insight on this child and family that can give us some good information as to what kind of recommendations we need to make to the court.
Okay. And Linda, you are an attorney for the parents. And we're skipping ahead a little bit here because we're not going in the sequence that these things might happen. But I just want to ask you the question. In your experience representing parents, how often do you see that the children are with them? Is that the majority or not the majority of the cases? In your caseload, I recognize you can't speak for...
Well, and I should explain, I have probably a more limited caseload because I'm a supervisor. So I would say most of the cases I handle, initially the children are not at home. My own practice is primarily focused on people with issues around addiction and substance use. So that's kind of my particular lens. I think one of the roles we play, though, just to build off of what Carla said, is when we get a case, we talk to the parent. If the child can't be at home, we talk to the parent about where else could the child live. So one of our very important roles is, I think, to interview that client in depth about alternative relative placements or family friend placements. And I do think that in the last couple of years, we've done a better job of working on that issue of getting kids to family or getting kids to a placement where they know that person. For example, sometimes it could be a teacher or some other adult that the child already knows. So again, that child isn't having to go into stranger care.
So parents are a help in that regard. I mean, you ask them, what can we do to get the child to a family-related placement, if not a family placement?
Correct. I mean, obviously, we take direction from our client. If the client says, I want my child back home right now, this minute, we would take that question to the judge. But I think often parents recognize there is something they need to work on before the child could be placed home. And so, again, we try to work on, what is the best interim plan, right? What is going to make you the most comfortable about where your child's living? How can we best address this while you maybe, and I guess I'll just use my case as an example, while you maybe obtain substance use treatment and try to overcome whatever has caused you to sort of come to the attention of child welfare.
Okay. And let me go back to Carla because we kind of jumped ahead a little bit. And let's kind of take a case at least in terms of processing from the beginning. So if someone makes a complaint and it is investigated and it's determined that this truly is a child in need of aid, then my understanding is that the person from the Office of Children's Services would file a petition for the court, or petition with the court. So do you draft that petition? Do you show up? What happens once that petition gets going? What's your role, and how did things unfold? How is Linda brought in as the parent, and how is Leanne brought in as a representative for the child?
Mm-hmm. Well, you're correct. If a child is removed on an emergency basis, meaning they're in immediate danger, then the department, the OCS worker, will write a petition. It's called a petition for adjudication of a child in need of aid. And it contains the facts, as the department sees them, supporting the idea that the child, in fact, has been abused or neglected. They file that with the court within 24 hours of the child being removed from the home. And the court, by statute, this is all in statute, sets on a hearing within 48 hours after that point. So within 72 hours or less from the time a child is removed from their home, there will be a court appearance to put that petition in front of a judicial officer somewhere in the state. And sometimes that's a magistrate judge, sometimes that's a superior court judge. That's one of the things that differs across the state in how that would work. But some judicial officer is looking at that within 72 hours. It's actually from the time we file the petition is, I believe, and Leanne can correct me if I'm wrong, when that the GALs are assigned from the very, very beginning. And so they are always at the first hearing, at that 72-hour hearing. And it's at that hearing also that the parents are asked if they would like an attorney. They do have the right to an attorney to help them through these proceedings. They're advised of that right. And if they can't afford an attorney, then there is a process for finding out if they qualify financially for a court-appointed attorney.
All right. For those of you who might be tuning in late, our guests today are CASA Director and Guardian Ad Litem, Leanne, Reeks? Okay. Assistant Attorney General for Child Protection, Carla Erickson, and Deputy Public Defender, Linda Beecher. Our expert co-host, Senior Judge Elaine Andrews, she's leading the discussion today about children in need of aid and the process of protecting abused and neglected children in Alaska. You can reach us with your questions or comments today on our local phone number, 550-8433. Call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752 or email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. Before we move forward anymore, something stuck with me that you said, a dramatic increase in the number of kids who are out of home. Is that what you said in the last year? Do we have the first thing that popped in my head is why? Like what's going on? Does anybody have any idea? I mean, I don't know, but what's the reason for this tick?
And this is actually one of the questions I think that OCS would be in the best position to answer.
Okay.
But Christy Lawton spoke to this, the director of OCS, frequently during the last legislative session when this obviously was discussed at length. In no small part is due to a massive raging heroin and opiate problem.
Okay.
In Alaska.
Yeah.
Meth as well is still strong and alive, meth use. But also going back to the number of PSRs, Protective Services reports, that were being investigated in years past, not enough were being investigated. Too many were being what they call screened out. And so it was even less than 55% of the cases that were being called in were investigated. And OCS wondered if perhaps that was meant that some children were being left in unsafe situations. And so more PSRs started to be investigated from the beginning, which unfortunately has resulted in a greater number, one of the factors of a greater number of
the
kids.
The PSR, I'm sorry, I must...
is a Protective Services report,
okay.
And that's what they call the allegation that gets called in to OCS.
Gotcha. So really... I asked the question because I wondered if it was more of a recognition and an investigation. We're doing more of that, or if there is a bigger problem. But you're saying it's likely a combination of those two things.
Those and other factors, yes.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Sorry. I guess.
And Linda, are you seeing that on the parent side? In other words, are you seeing parents who are being assigned to you because children have been taken in connection with this, the opiate addiction issues that are going on?
I think that's a huge problem. And again, we don't really keep particular statistics on the nature of the cases, but I think it's fair to say that I would agree with Carla on the issues around substance use, heroin, methamphetamine, and those are just very difficult to treat. I think we're still, as a community, grasping with how to best offer treatment to these folks and parents when this is the primary issue that brings them into the child welfare system.
Yeah, because unless that's addressed, it will never change. I mean, it won't get better. And heroin, opiate addiction is, I mean, that's something we've been talking about a lot, and it gets you, and it's tough. So... that's a big problem.
So maybe I'll just ask a general question, and whoever wants to join in terms of the availability of treatment for parents who are, you know, desperate to get their kids back and to beat this problem. Does anyone have any information about what's available for parents in state? both rural and urban-based parents.
I can say, I'll take this, since I've done a lot of, we've done some addiction shows and a lot of research on this, but the reality is there's not enough treatment. And if somebody gets, you know, their child is taken into custody and they get court ordered into like opiate treatment, they get put on that waiting list and they start the process of waiting. And when they're ready is the time to strike. So the number one thing, and this is what one of my guests on one of the shows said, the number one way to change this is more treatment options and more supports for these folks, because heroin addiction, any addiction is a really tough thing, but it's heroin addiction and is especially, and meth is horribly, kills most of the people that get involved with it unless intense intervention. So we do not have enough of that. And these people will not get better unless there is intervention.
Well, and this is Linda. I would agree with that. And again, I think it's even worse in our outlying communities.
Yeah, in the rural communities, for sure.
I do think we're seeing, as I said in our discussions before we came here, we're seeing a little bit of improvement because of the availability of Medicaid. I think having Medicaid funds for low-income folks is going to help us build up treatment options. And I think that will assist us in this endeavor.
Well, and Prentice, you were saying there isn't enough treatment, so people get put on wait lists. But let me go back to Carla. Don't we have a timing issue here, where once a child is out of the home, I know things have changed dramatically over the last decade or two in terms of how long the state will keep a child in its custody before a permanent plan is made for them to have a permanent home. So what is the timing, and how has that changed over the years in terms of that?
And I actually don't think I answered the rest of your questions last time about whether or not we review the petitions and what happens from the beginning. So maybe I'll just kind of start there. Some AGs around the state, again, this is one of those instances where there might be regional differences, are able to review the petitions before they're filed, but very frequently they're written by the worker because it's on such a tight time frame. It's 24 hours. And the worker is trying to also get notice to the parent that the petition is being filed and provide them information on where they need to be and when they need to be, and hopefully some assistance in getting there if they need that assistance. So that first hearing happens at 72 hours. That's the probable cause hearing. And there are a lot of hearings in child need of aid cases, a lot of mandated hearings. The probable cause hearing is the first one. As the cases progress, if we agree, if the court agrees that there's a fair probability or substantial chance the child could be a child in need of aid with the information that we have at the time, then the court finds probable cause. We discuss whether or not the child can be maintained safely in the home with a safety plan, as Leanne mentioned, or whether or not, if the child's already been removed, can they go home somehow, or do they need to stay in out-of-home care? Then the next thing is the adjudication hearing, which is 4 months later, where we have to prove, in fact, whether or not the child was a child in need of aid by the preponderance of the evidence. More than half of the evidence would point to the fact the child is a child in need of aid. Shortly thereafter, we have a disposition hearing, which essentially answers the question, okay, what are we going to do about that? How do we fix that? What is the roadmap? And that's where the OCS case plan is really front and center, the star of that show, in deciding and discussing what services are appropriate for the parents, and if they've been involved, hopefully they've already been involved in services, how they're doing. And then at about 9 months, the department starts, by policy, looking at how the family's doing overall and whether or not they're progressing towards reunification, hopefully quickly enough, right? Certainly, the younger the children are, we want to see families reunified sooner rather than later. Permanency for very young children is extremely important. And so at 9 months, OCS starts looking at that. And then at 12 months, we have our permanency hearing, where the court takes a look at the progress the parents have made. And getting to your question about the timelines, the statutes say, and this is also federal law, that at 15 months, after the child has been out of home care for 15 of the last 22 months, by law, the department is required to file a petition to terminate the parental rights, to free that child for some other form of permanency through adoption, ideally adoption or guardianship. You don't have to terminate to get to guardianship, but we have to start moving towards some other form of permanency unless there's a compelling reason not to.
Okay. So it sounds like after the first hearing of probable cause, there's about a 4-month hiatus when I'm imagining things should be happening. Let me ask Linda, what happens between probable cause and the next hearing that's 4 months later? What role do you play in that interim?
Well, we focus on a couple of different things. I think just to maybe go back to first steps, the first step obviously would be for us to review the petition with the parent to understand their response to it. We look at the government's file. We do our own investigation if necessary. So again, you may have a parent who has a lot of disagreements with the allegations and with the claims, and if so, that parent has every right to take that question to the judge as to whether or not the government has a sufficient reason to continue with the intervention in the family. But assuming that that is decided either by agreement or with a judicial order, we do try to really focus on, you know, sort of what happens next, right? I would say one key issue for us is where the child's placed. I talked a little bit about that. I think the next question is how and when can the parent see that child? And again, the philosophy of the Office of Children's Services is to provide as normal an opportunity for parent-child contact as possible. Now, again, that's obviously complicated by whatever the concerns are, but the system as a whole tries to provide reasonable, normalized contact between the parent and child. And we know from the research that's best for both the parent and the child. It helps children adjust to placement better when they have better family contact. It helps the parent when they, you know, see their child, they're reassured, okay, maybe my child's not living with me, but I'm still seeing my child. And that helps them, I think, really cope with the crisis that in their family, right? The next thing we focus on, though, is what has to happen? What is the parent supposed to do? And how is the Office of Children's Services helping that parent? Because throughout the case, the Office of Children's Services has an obligation to assist that parent in their rehabilitation. And so our job in part is to make sure that's happening and happening in a meaningful way. Under federal law, there's no later than 60 days, the Office of Children's Services has to provide what's called a case plan to the parent. And that should really outline for the parent kind of what's the game plan, right? What is it you need to do to address the concerns that we have? They do have to work on that plan with the parent. So it's a cooperative effort. Ideally, everybody agrees. but those are really the most important steps, I would say, focusing on is the placement appropriate? Is it consistent with what our client wants? Is the family contact appropriate, consistent with what our client wants? Is there a case plan that is meaningful, appropriate, reasonable?
All right. And Leanne, in the meantime, there's a little one, and you are either the guardian or you're supervising a CASA who is focused on this child. In this period of time after probable cause, while the child is not in the home, actually, I have a question, first of all. Carla talked about if the child can be returned home with a safety plan. What in your experience have you seen as safety plans can you describe that for the public?
I'd say on most occasions it's a relative who can either move into the home to help monitor or check on the child frequently, check in hopefully every day. Sometimes it's a group of people who agree to help monitor the family and have eyes on them fairly consistently to make sure that the children are safe.
Okay, so that would be returning the children home with a safety plan.
Correct.
Okay. And then the other alternative is they're out of the home and now you are the guardian and Linda's working with the parents to get them moving maybe towards treatment if they need treatment. What are you doing for the child in the meantime? What kinds of things are you looking at? What would be your focus here? And Linda talked about making sure the parents and the children get together. Do you facilitate that? What's your role?
At times we facilitate family contact, but we also feel very strongly that family contact is very important. to happen between children and their parents, especially the younger ones. So we try to bring that up as an issue at the meetings and in hearings to see if that's being happening. At times when there's not anyone else available, we will supervise visitations. Carla mentioned the increase in cases we've had lately, which has affected all agencies. And so guardian ad litem caseloads they're huge. It's in the hundreds at this point. So
per
full-time guardian ad litem. So trying to see all of our kids on a regular basis has been a nightmare. That's why CASAs are so important and valuable, because they can take that role of visiting with the children and make sure their needs are met, and then reporting back to the guardian ad litem and reporting back to the judge. Another role of ours is to make sure those needs are being met. We work with the schools a lot to make sure the kids are getting the educational needs they need, mental health therapy. All kids that come into custody are traumatized in some way because they've been separated from their parents most of the time. So we really try to facilitate them being assessed, having a mental health assessment to make sure, to find out what other kinds of services they need. We try to get into the home as much as possible to make sure that things are going well, whether that be a foster home, relative home, parents' home. So it's real important for us to be able to see the kids on a regular basis.
Which it sounds like is really, really difficult to do. So you need more CASAs? I mean, is that something people in the community can get involved in?
Yes,
if they wanted to volunteer?
We're always in need of CASAs.
And how would they go about
Our website is AlaskaCASA, AlaskaCASA.org. And emails anytime. We have different CASA community regional programs. We have in the Valley, Juneau, Fairbanks. We have a collaboration between us and the Kenaitse tribe and AVCP in Bethel, who are running tribal courts. So if you get a hold of someone, or you get a hold of me usually with that website, I will make sure you get to the correct person who can help you get through that process.
Okay, and I'll make sure we have that on our website. And I'm sure if you Google CASA or CASA, and it'll come up and you can find it. We're at the halfway point, a little bit past in our show, so let's go ahead and take a short break. You're listening to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. Our guests today are CASA Director Leanne Ricks, Assistant Attorney General for Child Protection, Carla Erickson, and Deputy Public Defender Linda Beecher. Our topic today is children in need of aid and the state's role in protecting abused and neglected children. Reach us at 550-8433. Call toll-free 1-888-353-5752 and email your questions to hometownalaska.org. After this short break, we'll continue our conversation about protecting Alaska's most vulnerable and valuable resource. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. This is Prentice Pemberton sitting in today for hometown host Kathleen McCoy. If you're just tuning in, our expert co-host is Senior Judge Elaine Andrews. She's leading an informative discussion about the enormous and important job of protecting Alaskan children. The guests today are CASA Director Leanne Ricks, Assistant Attorney General for Child Protection Carla Erickson, and Deputy Public Defender Linda Beecher. Our topic today is children in need of aid protecting abused and neglected children. Once again, email your questions or comments, hometown@alaskapublic.org. You can call locally at 550-8433, toll-free 1-888-353-5752. Please remember, the show repeats tonight at 8. So if you're listening to this on Wednesday evening, you'll be hearing a taped recording, and we won't be able to accept phone calls, obviously. All right, before we get back, I just want to make a comment. When you get a child gets taken out of their home, it is a traumatic experience, and you mentioned that a little bit, Leanne. It's I don't care if the parents are, you know, parents of the year, or if they're just good enough parents, and you know, by the statutes of the law, children are attached to their parents, and this is a really traumatic thing. And I do have sort of a bone to pick about that. You mentioned getting them in with therapy or support services. Well, Medicaid has a law that, or a rule that kids can't see a therapist unless there's a psychiatrist on staff. And I don't know that that's changed yet. I've heard some talk about it. There's big wait lists, 9 months. And you got a kid who's taken from their home. They don't have time. They're 5, 6 years, 7 years old. They don't have 9 months to get put on a waiting list because it's happening now. Are you guys seeing a huge problem in accessing those resources for children? Do we need to do something about that as a state to sort of open up that so we can see some of these kids and keep them from being re-traumatized and not being able to process everything that's going on? This is a big deal. It gets me kind of worked up.
Yeah, it's a huge problem.
Okay.
We do have most all our kids on wait lists, and it's very difficult to actually tell parents or foster parents, I know they need help. I know you're having issues with
right.
them, but we have nothing to offer you at this point. I do know OCS, when the kids are on a wait list, they will provide out-of-pocket services or pay for services for kids out-of-pocket up to 10 sessions. That has helped immensely. I do want to say, too, that the mental health agencies in Anchorage are improving with the new trauma project that deals specifically with the child's trauma and tries to get to the bottom of that to help them cope with whatever's going on. But unfortunately, there's not enough of these programs to meet the needs of all our kids.
Yeah, I've been contacted a whole bunch of times, and I've had 3 or 4 of those cases where they say, we'll just pay you to see the kid. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, and every now and then a parent has insurance, you know, if they have a job, and that's great. But this is, it's a problem. And these kids don't need medications. They need somebody to talk to who's neutral and who's going to support them and listen to them. All right, let's go to, before we keep going here, let's go. We have a caller. You have an experience in foster care. Jim, you're on the line.
Yes, back when I was in the system, they call them welfare homes, so that kind of gives you a bit of information about my age, but the memories are still there. And I was in 13 of them, and consequently 13 different schools and everything that goes wrong with that. But one thing that I would just wanted to pass on to folks that deal with foster kids is that basically for my experience, I was just somebody else's dog. And it took about probably three days before you made the first mistake. You found out what the rules were, and you found out what the rules were the hard way. You didn't know what the rules were until you broke the rules. So just to keep that in mind, and it's great that, you know, our society is looking after these things, but we're going to continue producing these problems just like we create wars and poverty and all kinds of things in society. But, you know, there's no panacea. There's no one thing that's going to fix it. It's a sad truth. And that was my experience, and I still deal with it.
Yeah, I'm sure that you do. Jim, I really appreciate the call. That's a great point. And I want to just take a second to, you know, hopefully, Jim, what you're talking about in the welfare homes is a different era and a different time. And I've interviewed from some folks about some of the boarding school experiences that they had, some of the local Native folks and some of the abuse and the trauma that they went through. And I do think that's a really good point, that stuff, it happened, and that's a shame. And you are dealing with the long-term scars of that. And you know, have to battle that. But I'm hoping, and I believe, since I had a foster home for 13 years, I was a foster parent, therapeutic foster parent for some of the most difficult kids in the state, and we were pretty well vetted and we were pretty well trained. And I'm hoping, Jim, that because of stuff that kind of things that happen to you, that this is changing and that we have more protections in place to look at the backgrounds of these people. And can somebody talk a little bit about how foster homes, because my kid's going to a stranger, I want to know, what do you know about this person? And I think that's what Jim's speaking to. So thanks for the call, Jim, and you bring up a really good point.
This is Carl. I can speak a little bit about that. Certainly, I think everyone would agree, it still continues to be the case that anytime a child has to be moved, it's very traumatic. And those of us in child welfare know that to be true. And we try and minimize placement changes as much as possible. I know OCS very much is focusing on trying to find a good foster home from the start, somewhere that the kids can remain for the life of the case if necessary, and possibly be even a permanent home if reunification is not a possibility. And like we said, most kids, about 50% or so, are placed with relatives. And so that's ideal. Somebody the kid knows and feels comfortable with, or a family friend, someone else the child knows and feels comfortable with, to mitigate some of that trauma. But if the child has to be in a licensed foster home, somebody they're not familiar with, then there is a licensing process. There are background checks for those individuals who want to be licensed, and educational requirements and home checks. And that has to be kept up on a yearly basis. There are requirements for OCS to see the children wherever they're placed at least once a month, so you have eyes on to make sure everything's going okay in the home, as well as usually the kids are in a fair number of services. And so we have other sources of information on how the kiddo is doing, therapists and GALs and CASAs, and parents who are visiting too. So as I said, there's actually a licensing manual and some information on being a foster parent on the OCS website. And OCS always needs more foster homes, people willing to be foster parents, and in particular, Native Alaskan or American Indian foster homes. So if you're interested in being a foster parent, please visit the OCS website, and they will be happy to provide you information on how to become a foster parent.
So I want to follow up with two things. One would be, we're talking about, Leanne talked about the Kenaitse tribe as partnering with the CASA program. We don't have time, because it's a whole big new topic that we'll take up at some other point, about the Indian Child Welfare Act and the changes that are coming. But Carla, if you wouldn't mind just commenting a little bit about the Indian Child Welfare Act and how it operates in the child protection area. And then after that, I want to go to Linda to talk to us about the therapeutic court for families. So if we can hear a little bit about what is the Indian Child Welfare Act? What's its purpose? And how is it changing? How are these new changes? What's happening?
Sure. So the Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA, as it's referred to commonly, was passed in 1978. And it's a federal law that places more restrictions on and standards around Alaska Native or American Indian children in foster care. So, for example, if Alaska Native or American Indian child has to be removed from their home, the standards, what we have to prove in order for that to be necessary, is higher than that of a child who is not American Indian or Alaska Native. Also, placement preferences, that's actually written into statute. I've been mentioning it all afternoon about placement with family, but it's actually written into the statutes, both in state statutes and in the ICWA, about first placement preference is always going to be with a family member. And that's also in the Indian Child Welfare Act. Also, it places a higher burden on the agency to provide active efforts to facilitate reunification of the child with the parent. And in non-ICWA cases, the standard would be reasonable efforts. So that's what ICWA is. And very recently, there's been some changes. The federal government just issued some regulations on the Indian Child Welfare Act that go into effect on December 12th, which I think I know I'm happy about. They're very welcome because they give some much needed guidance on issues that have kind of been percolating and never settled through litigation in other cases. And so I know all the agencies, I know Linda and I talk about it frequently, how we're both trying to absorb. It's a lot. It's a big change. It's a lot of information. Representatives from the BIA, Bureau of Indian Affairs, were just up a couple weeks ago giving trainings on the issue. Anyway, we're trying to digest all of this and incorporate it into our daily practice and it, like I said, they go into effect December 12th, and I think it's going to produce some positive changes.
So, and the general theory behind ICWA is that children are not only the children of parents, they're the children of a tribe, and that has mm-hmm. to be considered in handling those kinds of cases.
Yes, and I should say that we do have a disproportionality problem in Alaska. There are higher numbers of Alaska Native children in care than should be. So Alaska Native children only make up about, I think, 18 to 20% of the number of children under the age of 18 in Alaska, but they make up about 55% of the kiddos in foster care. So that's a disproportionate representation. That number's getting better. OCS is works hard at addressing that issue. It is getting better, but not nearly as quickly as anyone would like to see.
And that's also played out in the judicial system and in the homeless population, the disproportionality of Alaska Natives and minorities, which is a totally different show. If you're just joining us, our guests today are Leanne Reichs, Assistant Attorney General for Child Protection, Carla Erickson, and Deputy Public Defender Linda Beecher. Expert co-host Elaine Andrews, and our guests are discussing children in need of aid or China law. You can call us with your questions at 550-8433, toll free at 1-888-353-5752, or email your questions to hometown@alaskapublic.org. Back to you.
Okay. So, Linda, there is a specialized court that operates for these kinds of cases. Can you tell us something about that court and how does it operate different than a regular courtroom?
Well, about 2 years ago in Anchorage, we started what we call the China Therapeutic Court. And the focus of the court is really for parents who acknowledge having an issue with substance use and who are willing to be engaged in a recovery process. And we need statistics, but I think anecdotally I can say I've had a lot of success with my clients who've gone through that. I think part of it is because we really meet people at the moment of crisis. We really try to make them feel sort of welcomed into the court, that we're there to help them, that they're being helped by the team. Our judges are really warm and wonderful, and so I think it's just very powerful to have a judge say, welcome to my courtroom. We're here to help you. We want to see you get your children back. For parents to have that relationship with the judge, I think, is really a key component to the court. But the other thing, and my other big sales pitch to my clients is, when you go into this court, you're really going to be with a group of people who can support you and who are going to support you in sobriety and in recovery. So, you know, they're not alone in the courtroom. Our cases are normally, even though the hearings are open, it's very much sort of one by one. And so a parent can feel pretty isolated in a courtroom when they're kind of the parent and there's this whole other cast of characters, nobody, frankly, sometimes who looks anything like them. And they're kind of the ones in the hot seat because they're the ones with the problem. When people are in our therapeutic court, we kind of have the whole group. Everybody's working together towards the goal of recovery and towards the goal of reunifying their family and getting their kids home. And we have more resources to bear. I think they're more time consuming for those of us doing the court, but I think we're yielding real benefits. My hope is that we can expand on that in other communities. Again, I think it would need to be a community-based model, because I feel like in different communities, particularly in a rural community, it might look and feel differently. But I think the idea is really to, again, encourage wellness, encourage recovery, and help people get their children home faster.
Okay.
And this is Carla, and add to that. I also work with Linda on the China Therapeutic Court, and I'm proud of it and how well it's doing. There are also a number of other therapeutic courts. Palmer is trying to get a therapeutic court off the ground for kiddos 0 to 3, focusing on younger children coming into care. There is the startup of a joint jurisdiction down in Kenai with the Kenaitse tribe that will be over. Some China cases will be subject to that as well. But the reason I think therapeutic courts are so beneficial is because I'm going to get on my soapbox a little bit, but you know, you've got lawyers here talking about litigation in the courtroom, but a lot of the hard work of these cases actually takes place outside of the courtroom or in a more collaborative setting. I firmly believe that the professional should be modeling for parents and families how to solve problems instead of fighting about them. So while it's true that sometimes we have to go in front of a court and a judge, have a judge decide. Sometimes that just, and that's everyone's right, and sometimes we have to do that. Sometimes that's also destructive for families because it's contentious. It destroys relationships. I know that my attorneys across the state work hard at staffing cases with OCS, troubleshooting as issues come up to try and avoid unnecessary litigation, things like going to mediation, other problem-solving techniques, and trying to be as collaborative as possible. Not only, because it's best for the families, frankly. And that's, I think that's what we need to be focused on in litigation. Fighting it out in court is not always the best end to a problem. And it depends on where you are in the state. Some places are a little more litigious than others, but I think everyone agrees that, in the end, everyone shares the same goal.
Sounds more like about collaboration and healing and support than it does about punishment and punitive measures for families, which is not very productive typically. Along with that, I have a email that says it's an interesting question. You could take it a couple of ways, but how long do the parents have to keep doing the right things, what the judges and the reps are telling them to do, before they can get their kids back? So it could be taken two ways. Like, how long do I got to, like, toe this line and then I can get back to my life? Or how long do I have to prove the changes? How long, is there a timeline? Is it just when everybody kind of feels like, hey, you've done a great job, like, let's just turn it over? What's the process there?
I'll start off. This is Carla. I think that's a very fact and case specific question. So someone who has had a substance abuse problem for the last, 10 or 15 years, in order for the practitioners and the child welfare professionals to feel comfortable returning a child into that home, we're going to need to see more than, for example, 2 months of sobriety, right? So it depends on the nature of the issue that's presenting in the family, the services that they're in. And it really is, we need to see behavioral change and feel comfortable that the parents will be able to meet minimum parenting requirements. This is keeping the child safe, making sure their basic needs are met, mental health needs, medical needs, emotional needs.
Okay, so there's not a time.
Not a set time.
No, and again, this is Linda. From our perspective, we're not always going to agree with the timeline that the government thinks is correct. And I would say, in child welfare, we're normally looking at issues around safety, right? Is the child safe? Is the child generally is removed because the government feels that child was seriously unsafe in the home? And so, as Carla said, you're not looking back. You're not looking to have perfect parents. You're not looking at parents to do every single thing that maybe they should do or could do to become perfect parents. So the question does become, when is it safe enough for that child to come back? And ultimately, that is a judicial decision if parties can't agree. But I would also touch on what Carla said. We do have options we do a lot of negotiating. We can use mediation, which sometimes can be very powerful. Also gives the parent sometimes a stronger voice in what's happening to them and what's happening with their family. We also can use a judicial settlement, and sometimes just sitting down with a judge who's good at kind of getting people to agree can be very powerful. Or we can have hearings and evidence and do trials.
Oh, I'm glad the standard is not perfection, because then the state would have all of our children.
Right. Yes. Yes.
And Leanne, are you active in the therapeutic courts? Is that something that that you've been involved in as a guardian?
Not myself personally, but my supervisor, Anita Alves, is the guardian ad litem for all the therapeutic court children.
Okay. Well, I did a little bit of work before I retired. We called it a different kind of court. I think it was called the family care court at the time. And I can tell you, it's a very different experience as a judge to preside over the therapeutic courts. It's a sea change in the way judges relate to the lawyers, relate to the litigants. It's very freeing. It's very satisfying procedure from a judicial point of view. And it does really yield results. It is incredibly time intensive and resource intensive. And it is a shame that that isn't the way the entire system works all the time, but it's a goal.
It feels better for everybody, judges, lawyers, families.
Yeah, I think so. Too bad we can't replicate it in every courtroom in every community in the state. I think that those are helpful. Well, in the sad situation where people have come together, they've tried everything that they can, and it hasn't worked out. What's the ultimate, what happens? Maybe I can ask Carla that question to lead off.
Well, at that point, especially if we've been operating and working on the issues for 15 months, like I said, the law requires us to file a termination petition to terminate parental rights, to free the child for adoption, or we can look for another form of permanency. Most of our cases do reach some amount of settlement. I mean, again, it depends where you are in the state, but a lot of our cases settle, and that's because we can come to agreement, and oftentimes the parents will understand that perhaps they're not ready to have their kiddos with them. Not all the time, and certainly we can and do go to trial, but ideally people can come to an agreement not only about that, but where the child should be long-term, and we can, for example, take relinquishments or consents or go to guardianship, which are all alternatives for permanency.
Okay. And if a person disagrees with termination, they can appeal that decision. If the court says your rights are terminated, the parent whose rights are terminated has the right to appeal, and the Alaska Supreme Court will make the final decision.
On an expedited basis,
yes. Okay.
Final thoughts. Anything you want to leave us with? We are at the end of our show already. Real quickly, just a second. Go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, this is Leanne, and I just have been thinking, and I think one of the pieces that's missing in this system is relative and family friend searches. In the beginning, not a lot of relatives come up, say, I want to take this kid, and they'll wait and say, I'm waiting for the parents, you know, they'll get it together, and they wait and they wait and they wait, and in the meantime, the child's placed with strangers. And they start to get close to these strangers. The strangers start to get close to them. And then, you know, we're getting to the further down the road towards termination. And then we have a relative who says, oh, they're not going to get together. I want to, you know, look at adopting them. But this child's already been with these other people for a very long time. So I guess my push is to, if you know a child's in custody, if you know of any relatives, any family, friends, anyone, a church member, anybody who knows this child, if you can come forth right away and get your name in there so the child can be placed with somebody they know early on.
Get involved early.
Right.
I would echo that. I think that families who feel supported during this time of crisis, whether it be by family, friends, by relatives, by their peer group, if they can find a healthy peer group, I think that's really what helps people succeed. When parents are treated with compassion, and given the message you can succeed, we see success. People overcome their problems. They can become safe parents.
I would agree with everything Leanne and Linda said. And I would also just say that, you know, I've never met anyone in child welfare that wasn't there because they really cared.
All right. I want folks to remember the general election is November 9th. Polls will be open from 7 a.m. until 8 p.m. Remember to bring identification when you go vote. In addition to voting for the U.S. President, senators, representatives, and state senators and representatives, there are 33 Alaska judges up for retention in November. There's more information at the Division of Elections website, knowyouralaskajudges.org. Kathleen McCoy will return next week for, I'm not sure what she's going to be talking about, but I'm sure it's going to be interesting and informative, so tune in next week. Dave Waldron is the web editor and audio engineer for today's show. We really appreciate you taking the time to join us today for Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. Until next time, I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day. November 8th.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.